I'm David Martin Davies, and coming up on The Source, four presidents carved into the side of a mountain. It was a dream that was beyond ambitious. But when first proposed, it was thought to be a joke. Yet Mount Rushmore exists, it's visited by millions every year, it's a symbol of national pride and the power of the will of one man, sculptor Gutzon Borglum. But the story of the mountain is much deeper than the postcard image. To the Lakota Sioux, Mount Rushmore's story is one of cultural desecration of a sacred site called Six Grandfathers Mountain and the theft of their land. The monument represents a history of broken treaties and the ongoing struggle for the return of the Black Hills. Can the debate over Mount Rushmore ever be reconciled? This is a community conversation. We want to hear from you. Call in at 833-877-8255. That's what's coming up on The Source, but first, this news.
Support for The Source podcast comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas' largest academic research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at uthealthsa.org.
Have a property past its prime? Consider donating it to Texas Public Radio. It's hassle-free, and you may qualify for a tax write-off, too. Learn more at tpr.careasy.org/realestatedonation.
Live from the John L. Santico studio in downtown San Antonio, this is The Source from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Mount Rushmore is one of America's most iconic monuments. Over 2 million people visit it in South Dakota each year. They gaze at the massive carvings of four presidents and really can't help but be moved by the scale of it and the clear superhuman effort that it took to make it. But there's so much more to the story. The four presidents are carved into the Black Hills, land that is sacred to the Lakota people. For them, this is a painful symbol of colonization, betrayal, and erasure. Historian and author Matthew Davis explores these contradictions in his new book, A Biography of a Mountain, The Making and Meaning of Mount Rushmore. Matt Davis, welcome to The Source.
Thanks so much, David. It's great to be here.
I want to ask you first about the title, The Biography of a Mountain. It's not a biography of a monument. You're looking at the mountain. Is it important for us to really kind of think about it, draw a distinction right off the bat as we begin this conversation, that we have to think about the monument, which a shrine of democracy, as separate from the mountain?
Yeah, that's, you know, that was my intention in naming it such. And the cover of the book does a great job of illustrating just how small the actual sculpture is on Mount Rushmore. And that's really what I wanted to do. I mean, obviously, it's important to talk about the sculpture and the monument itself and the work that Gutzon Borglum did to create it. But I wanted to sort of decentralize that in favor of centralizing the mountain of Mount Rushmore and then the broader context of the Black Hills of South Dakota. And I think doing so is really important for the story that I wanted to tell in this book.
And to you focus on the fact, the Lakota people, that this is a painful symbol for them. This is sacrilegious desecration of their own monument.
Well, it's, you know, I think it's very complicated and goes to the story of how the Black Hills came to be in the hands of the United States. I think that, you know, many, you know, Lakota people are not monolithic, and many different Lakota people have very different ideas of Mount Rushmore. But certainly many people, not just of the Lakota, but many other Native Americans and even some non-Native Americans view Mount Rushmore, you know, less as a symbol, as a shrine of democracy, and more as a symbol that reflects manifest destiny and the westward movement of Europeans and Americans as they moved west. We moved west across this continent, which resulted, of course, in the deaths of millions of people. And I think, you know, in the Black Hills in particular, how the Black Hills came to be in American hands and sort of the historical generational trauma that has taken place for the Lakota people in and around the Black Hills makes it an incredibly makes it very problematic for many Lakota people in an area, the Black Hills, that they deem as the heart of everything that is, in an area that is full of their sacred sites. So to have the memorial built in the hills is very problematic.
So many people might think, well, this is a debate that's settled. Mount Rushmore is there. People go there every year, visit it. It is part of America. And to have this these questions asked that they don't see it as something that is to be considered. They think this is a settled story. The narrative is there. That's what we're going to do. How do you try to reopen that narrative? How do you reopen and say there is a present debate that needs to be discussed?
Well, I'm not the one that is reopening the narrative. I think that's there has been narratives that have been present at Mount Rushmore for decades. And I think, in particular, in 2004, so I first saw Mount Rushmore in 2000 when I just finished college. And at that time, this is before 9/11, there had just been a great deal of construction to the memorial. It had been sort of buttressed by a big parking lot. It had become more of a quote unquote national memorial. And at that time, there really wasn't any information at the memorial about the history of the Lakota people, the history of other Native American tribes who had called the Black Hills home for thousands of years. And that changed in 2004 when the first Native American superintendent at Mount Rushmore came to the memorial. And his name was Gerard Baker. And he had had a long history in the National Park Service of centralizing Native American stories at our national parks. He did so at the Battle of Little Bighorn Memorial in Montana. He did so at the Lewis and Clark Expedition, celebrating the 200th anniversary of that expedition west. And so he did the same at Mount Rushmore, and he began to introduce more Native stories, more Native histories, more Native themes, and hired Native American interpreters to tell the stories of the Lakota and other tribes that called the Black Hills home. And so I was not introducing any new narratives that hadn't been there before. But I think it's important to emphasize, especially in the context that we're in today in the United States, that historical narratives, American historical narratives, are very complicated and they're very complex. And I think we're better for it when we can introduce all these complicated themes to a place like Mount Rushmore, which is, as you said, it's very pretty on a postcard, and they serve Thomas Jefferson ice cream there, and it's a place where people really want to feel prideful in the United States, and that's fine. There should be places where we can feel patriotic and prideful as Americans, but maybe Mount Rushmore, maybe a place in the Black Hills is not one of those places.
Thomas Jefferson ice cream is his original vanilla recipe. So if anyone's wondering what that is. So
That's right. Yeah, it's not 200-year-old ice cream, let's be clear.
like his wine. We're having a similar debate here in San Antonio over the Alamo right now, and there has been political pressure. They removed the president and CEO of the Alamo Trust recently over her attempts to be more inclusive in telling the Native American story of the Alamo. And there's been very hard efforts by ruling Republican leaders in Texas to silence that. They say we want to focus on the battle and not put more attention on the actual total history of that place. And so I imagine there's that tug of war is continuing with Mount Rushmore.
Yeah, I think it is. I think to what you're describing, and I did not know that about the Alamo. It sounds really fascinating. I'd like to learn more about it. And what you're describing is something that's very local. And I think in terms of the memorial at Mount Rushmore, a lot of these debates have already happened locally, and they're still happening. They're still very important. People feel them very deeply. The memorial itself has actually done a pretty good job of trying to complicate the history, and it's continuing to do so. I know that there are some new videos and his new videos that plan to be shown at the memorial in the visitor center that will complicate the history and tell the full history even more. But I think nationally, what you're seeing is this real discomfort with trying to tell the truth, historical truth. And there are many different people that want to tell a singular historical narrative, whether about the Alamo or about Mount Rushmore or about the United States. And when that happens, I just think that that's a real sign of weakness, of the inability to want to think critically and comprehensively about the national narratives that we have. And Rushmore has become a real political lightning rod in this way. I mean, my book got, I had the idea for it when Donald Trump spoke at Mount Rushmore on July 3rd, 2020, and gave a pretty narrow view of both American history and the memorials and monuments that are built to reflect that history.
We're going to pick up on that. We're going to hit this break. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio.
Support for this podcast of The Source comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' compensation provider committed to rewarding policyholders who keep their workers safe and losses low. More at texasmutual.com/TXM Advantage. Texas Mutual. Texans get it.
You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. We're joined by Matt Davis. His new book is A Biography of a Mountain, The Making and Meaning of Mount Rushmore. When we were going to break, you were talking, Matt, about President Trump at Mount Rushmore on July 3rd, 2020. Let's give a listen.
I am here as your president to proclaim before the country and before the world, this monument will never be desecrated. These heroes will never be defaced. Their legacy will never, ever be destroyed. Their achievements will never be forgotten. And Mount Rushmore will stand forever as an eternal tribute to our forefathers, and to our freedom.
So, Matt, what was he talking about?
Well, he was clearly talking, I mean, you got to remember the context of that speech. It came on July 3rd, 2020, when we as a country were really wrestling with our historical narratives, where there were many monuments, especially to the Confederacy, that were being toppled across the American South and across the rest of the country. A lot of communities were having conversations about, you know, whether to remove certain monuments and memorials. And so, you know, in that speech, President Trump was really giving his view of not just American history, but the memorials and monuments that were built to tell a certain kind of view of that history. And I think that's, you know, we were talking earlier just about, you know, can Mount Rushmore, you know, be beyond that sort of that image that Trump gives of an eternal tribute to our country. And I think, you know, one of the things that I would really sort of advocate is sort of, I mentioned Gerard Baker earlier. I mean, he would always, and I've talked to him for this book, he would always tell me that the Rushmore story is a tough story to tell. And if you're gonna do it, you have to do it where people sort of, you know, leave being a bit unsettled. And that's the kind of history that I think is more nuanced, more complicated, and more representative of the country that we are. And I think it's perfectly fine to have conversations about this and not have it be one way or another.
Stop looking at it as competing narratives, but complementing narratives. Can that happen?
I think it can, and I think that there's a real possibility for it. There's no reason why. I mean, I don't think that Mount Rushmore is a great representative of a place that we can be patriotically. I think it's important that we have memorials and monuments where we can feel pride in our country. I wonder whether Mount Rushmore is the best place for that. But I do think that Mount Rushmore, as it exists, does offer within itself the possibility of having these kinds of complicated questions that we as Americans sometimes are not that great at having.
Also at that event was the then governor, Kristi Noem. Describe the controversy with her and fireworks at that site.
Yeah, so it was actually Gerard Baker who had, when he was superintendent at Mount Rushmore, had stopped fireworks being launched during the Independence Day celebrations because of the environmental damage that was happening around Mount Rushmore. And Kristi Noem, when she came into office as governor for her first term in 2018, one of the first things she did was to reach out to President Trump to to see if fireworks can be reinstated at Mount Rushmore. And they were for the first time in over a decade. And that celebration that, that President Trump had on July 3rd, 2020, they have not been shot off since. And there is a lot of speculation, however, that they will resume next summer for the celebration of America's 250th birthday.
How did the carving of the mountain, why did that end up at Mount Rushmore? That who was Rushmore? Why do we have a mountain named after him?
You know, David, this is actually my favorite part of the story, and it's twofold. So Rushmore is named after Charles Rushmore. Charles Rushmore was a New York City lawyer who happened to be representing tin mine corporations in the 1880s in the Black Hills of South Dakota. And he was on a horse riding through the Black Hills with two guides. They came across this mountain. Charles Rushmore asked, you know, what this mountain was called. The guides didn't know. And they said, well, let's just name it Rushmore. And so that's what it became named. And so when the idea for Mount Rushmore developed, and I'll get to that story in a second, but when the idea for Mount Rushmore was being developed and they needed to have a fundraising campaign, Charles Rushmore was reached out to. He donated $5,000 to the development and the building of Mount Rushmore. And so I like to say that Charles Rushmore got away with the cheapest naming rights purchase in American history.
So arbitrary. And, you know, it's like he's not a national hero.
No, he's not. He's a New York City lawyer. And, I, you know, but the story of how Rushmore came to be in the Black Hills, how the memorial came to be in the Black Hills, I think is really fascinating. And it's something that not many Americans, I think, understand. Because I think because it's so monumental, because it's so big, because it's so grandiose, people believe that the idea came from either the federal government or from the sculptor himself, Clemson Borglum. But really the idea for a sculpture in the Black Hills came from a state historian, a man named Doane Robinson, who was sort of a Renaissance man, interested in many different aspects of state life, from the design of the state flag to the kind of alfalfa farmers grew, to the kinds of bridges that were being built over the Missouri River. And in the 1920s, Doane Robinson became very attuned to the economic hardships of South Dakota. South Dakota had done very well during World War I when European markets had tanked. A lot of the world were buying South Dakota crops and commodities. But when European markets recovered, the South Dakota economy tanked. And so Doane Robinson had this idea to spur on tourism and to build a sculpture in the Black Hills where the burgeoning number of car tourists would drive to the Black Hills to see this sculpture. And in his mind, he initially wanted to build a sculpture that reflected some of the characters of the American West. His first instinct was to include the Lakota leader Red Cloud, for example, or Lewis and Clark, or Sacajawea, or even George Armstrong Custer, to have them carved into the Black Hills. And so I often wonder, you know, what would Mount Rushmore be today if that idea had gone forward instead of the idea that the sculptor Gunson Borglum had of you know, taking this idea of a sculpture from the Black Hills, but changing it into a much more politically charged monument.
Did politics go into deciding who the four presidents would be?
Yeah, it did. I mean, politics from the standpoint of Gunson Borglum had a very specific idea initially of what he wanted Mount Rushmore to be. He wanted Mount Rushmore to reflect American empire and American expansion. So he chose four presidents that he felt, you know, represented that kind of empire. And today at the memorial, and this is true to the extent as the memorial being built, the four presidents represent different aspects of that American expansion. And so for George Washington, it's the birth of the United States. For Thomas Jefferson, it's the expansion of the United States in terms of the Louisiana Purchase. For Abraham Lincoln, it is the salvation of the Union with regards to him keeping the Civil War, the Union intact. And then for Theodore Roosevelt, it is the unification of the country with regards to the opening of the Panama Canal. And so those are how those presidents were chosen. But in Borglum's idea, he initially wanted to have this memorial, this monument, be sort of a representation, an homage to the apotheosis of Western civilization in the form of the political system that we have in the United States.
So Borglum, you've mentioned him a couple of times. Let's talk about this guy. I guess I should go ahead and talk about the fact he did spend some time in San Antonio. He did some early modeling of the Mount Rushmore when he was here. He had a studio which still stands today. It's on the Brackenridge Park Municipal Golf Course. It's an old stone pump house. But what was he? How did this guy become the person who was able to will Mount Rushmore into being?
Yeah, that's a great question. And he did spend time in San Antonio, and he's a very fascinating, complicated character. I mean, he was born in what is now Idaho to Mormon immigrants from Denmark, and spent the majority of his early life in Nebraska. Ended up spending his teenage years and really growing as an artist in Los Angeles before spending a decade in Europe, where he transformed himself from a painter into a sculptor. And when he came back to the United States, really began to engage in the craze of the day, which was monumental art and building monuments to American history and to American historical figures. And, you know, before he was at Mount Rushmore, he was the lead sculptor of Stone Mountain, the Confederate Memorial in Atlanta, Georgia. And he was fired from Stone Mountain just months before the first dedication of Mount Rushmore in 1925. And so he had lots of different experiences working with monuments, but also the Stone Mountain experience was crucial for him, both practically and philosophically. And so he took a lot of what he had learned from Stone Mountain when he went to Mount Rushmore and started work on there. Like I said, the first dedication of Rushmore was in October 1925, and construction started in 1927. But Borglum, he was a great artist. He was classically trained. He worked before he focused on sculpture in all kinds of different mediums. But he was, you know, he was a very controversial figure. His politics were very controversial. His personality was very abrasive. And he had a very singular view and vision of how he wanted Mount Rushmore to be. And at the end of the day, he was able to get that vision mostly across the finish line, although there are elements to the memorial that are absent today that he would have loved to have seen built in.
Stone Mountain, of course, is an icon to the Ku Klux Klan. And celebrates the Confederacy. Was he just a hired hand, or was he really, you know, a sympathizer with the Confederacy and the Ku Klux Klan?
There's no doubt that he was a sympathizer with the Ku Klux Klan. I haven't seen any documentation that he was officially a member of the Ku Klux Klan. There is some inclination or some documents that intimate that he was part of a national planning committee for the Ku Klux Klan, but certainly he was very friendly with Klan leadership. He introduced Klan leadership to national American politicians, including presidents. And he believed in certain elements of Klan ideology. I mean, he was very nativist. He did not like immigrants. He was very anti-Semitic. He was racist. But I think, you know, at the end of the day, it's hard to sort of disentangle, you know, that strand of Borglum's politics of personality with the actual, you know, practical fact that, as you said, the Klan controlled the purse strings at Stone Mountain. And so Borglum, if he wanted to complete this memorial, complete this monument, needed to have a good relationship with them.
I mean, that monument is, you know, they have huge celebrations. It's a like a propaganda piece, really.
It's crazy, David. I was born in Chicago. I have not spent a lot of time in the American South. And when I went down to Stone Mountain for the first time to see it, I was pretty shocked by not just the street names are named after Confederate generals and the carvings in the mountain, but the fact that there were pumpkin festivals there. There were, you know, rides and attractions for kids all amidst this, you know, large milieu of an homage to the Confederacy. And it just was, it was pretty jarring for me to sort of take that in. I'd never seen anything like that before.
And well, he was originally hired just to do a bust or something of Robert E. Lee. And he went and he enlarged the vision. I want to do this. And he made it big and large. It was really, you know, it sprung from his own brain to make that.
It did, yeah. I mean, in the same way that he transformed the idea of Mount Rushmore, he transformed the idea of Stone Mountain. I mean, the initial idea was to put a simple portrait of Robert E. Lee, and then Borglum, in his, really vivid imagination and creativity, wanted to create this tableau on the entire mountain of, Confederate generals, soldiers, Ku Klux Klan members, everyone swarming across that mountain. In a project that would have, honestly been almost impossible to finish. But ultimately, Borglum was fired and the work that he did on the mountain was blown off. So nothing you see on Stone Mountain was actually done by Gutzon Borglum, but he did have the original vision for it and he was the original sculptor.
All right, we're going to take another break. Bob, I'm going to get you on the air when we come back. Our phone lines are open, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. Mount Rushmore, the biography of a mountain, the making and meaning of Mount Rushmore. We're going to continue with Matt Davis when we come back from this break. Stay with us. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about one of the most iconic monuments in America, Mount Rushmore. Incredible in scale, the effort it took to produce it. But there's more to the story than just the postcard. We're speaking with the author of A Biography of a Mountain, The Making and Meaning of Mount Rushmore, Matt Davis. And you can call in with your questions and comments, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. Let's go to Bob on the phones. And Bob, you're on the air.
Hi, I know. Thank you. I know it's a little far-fetched, but I just wonder architecturally and politically whether it would be possible to put another president on there. I'm thinking of Obama especially because he's the first black man. He's the one who joined people together and saved the economy at that time, and historical presidential historians really believe that he's done more for this country than most of the presidents. I'd like to get your comments, please.
Bob, thank you for that. First off, can they add to anyone else? I know that there have been efforts. A congressperson tried to move something to add a Donald Trump to Mount Rushmore. Is that possible?
Yeah, so most people that I've spoken to on the National Park Service have said there is no more space on the mountain for another face. And so regardless of who people might want on Mount Rushmore, I think the fact is that there is no more room for another face. But you're right, David. There was legislation introduced in this most recent meeting of the House of Representatives. I guess it was early this year in 2025 to include President Trump on Mount Rushmore. And now, whether that legislation will get passed is something else, and whether if it is passed, if indeed there is space. I don't think there is.
So, I mean, it's a mountain. How can that be more space? Is it, I mean, Borglum had problems with some of the stone. He did an attempt on Jefferson on one side of Washington that the rock face was not strong enough. And so he had to blow that away and start again on the other side of Washington. So it's just that there is like limitations.
Yeah, I think when you look at the mountain from the front, it seems like there's ample space to get rid of some more mountain, get to the carvable granite, and maybe go ahead and carve another face. But what you don't see is the backside, which is very thin at places, and it just could not support the kind of work that would need to be done to put another face on the mountain. And you're exactly right, David. I mean, the initial idea was to put Jefferson to the left, if you're facing it, of George Washington, but there was too much dynamite that was, the story goes that Borglum was in Europe. I think it was maybe 1931, but he was in Europe to dedicate another memorial that he had built. And he came back and the workers had been a little bit too liberal with the dynamite and blew off more of the mountain than he had hoped. And he was not a very happy artist that day when he realized that, and so had to sort of transform the sculpture and put Jefferson to Washington's right. But most people that you speak to say that it is just not possible to fit another face, the size of these faces, on Mount Rushmore.
Let's go to the caller, Rachel. The number is 833-877-8255. Rachel, you're on the air.
Thank you. When I was in a Witte museum, I purchased one of those books about the history of San Antonio. And in there, they said that when Borglum was in San Antonio, he applied to be a sculptor for that renowned sculpture in front of the Alamo.
The Cenotaph.
Yes, sir. And he wasn't selected, but that could be the reason he came to San Antonio following to be one of those selected to be the sculptor.
All right, Rachel.
And that's all I wanted to.
Well,
the
thank
San
you.
Antonio books that are sold in all our museums are fantastic information.
All right. Well, thank you for that, Rachel. Thank you. What was Borglum doing? I mean, was he going around doing a lot of this type of work? Was he really a successful artist before Mount Rushmore?
Yeah, he was a very successful artist. He has pieces all across the country, in fact. And you know, he was in high demand. And he, you know, I don't think he really ever planned to live in the Black Hills, to live in South Dakota. But he ended up moving there with his family and spent, you know, his summer months in South Dakota working on Mount Rushmore. And then spent his winter months in San Antonio, I believe, in Texas, where he was busy doing a bunch of other artwork. He always had different irons in the fire. I mean, he was kind of insatiable in that way in terms of his level of creativity and desire to create. And he was very physically gifted. And what I mean by that is, like, well into his 60s, he would have no problem, you know, scrambling atop Mount Rushmore and really being hands-on in his work in ways, you know, that were, you know, the energy of someone maybe 30 years younger. And so he was a very prominent artist in his day. I mean, I think, you know, one of the things that has always struck me about Borglum as an artist is that he kind of is, in some ways, doesn't fit the mold of the modern artist at that time. And, you know, in the 1920s, 1930s, you're looking at all kinds of new waves of art that are coming out of Europe and even in the United States. And Borglum never really went for that kind of more modern art. He was always more of a classicist. And preferred to work, especially in the forms that he was working in with regards to sculpture and monumenture, in those terms. And, you know, it's funny because when he first started doing sculpture, those are some of my favorite works of his because they're a little bit more opaque. They're a little bit more, there's open to interpretation in some of the smaller pieces that he was doing before he went on to do these gigantic works of art that he has become very well known for.
Well, how unique is Mount Rushmore, that the carving, the scale, all of it? Is there anything else like that?
Stone Mountain is the only thing that is similar in the United States, I believe. I think there are some other works of art worldwide. For example, when Mount Rushmore was beginning to be debated as an idea, people sort of always referenced this sculpture called the Lion of Lucerne, which I believe is in Lucerne, Switzerland, but I'm not 100% positive about that. But that's sort of a lion carved into a mountain. But there's not many other examples of you know, works of art that are carved directly into the landscapes, into the mountainsides. There are several, but I don't sort of have them on the top of my head right now. But it's certainly distinctive for the United States.
And his plan was to do not just the heads, but the torsos of the presidents.
He wanted to do a bunch of things. He wanted to do the torsos, but even more important than that, he wanted to create a hall of records at Mount Rushmore that did lots of things at once. I mean, in true Borglum fashion, it was incredibly ambitious. He wanted to include smaller busts of Americans who had contributed to the United States over the course of its first 150 years. He wanted to literally place the original documents of the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution into this Hall of Records to sort of reflect why this memorial was being built. And he wanted to sort of give context to why these four faces were in this mountain. I think his, you know, one of his greatest fears was that that Rushmore would, you know, become kind of what the faces in Easter Island are, where they sort of are, but we don't really know exactly what they're doing there. And so he wanted to sort of, you know, prevent that by including all these other elements in a Hall of Records.
So that they would lose context. So they would just be, who are these guys? You know, whoever, you know, 1,000 years from now, people
exactly.
will be wondering, what the heck is that? Is that about the, I think people say this is one of the few things that would survive, 1,000 years from now, if people come back to the planet after it was, you know, abandoned, to look at that and say, okay, that was something.
Yeah, I mean, I think weather would have a say in that, you know, how the weather would affect the faces over the course of time. But I mean, I think the process would be very slow. So it's quite possible that in 1,000 years, if people were to come back, the faces or the outlines of the faces would still be there.
Well, didn't he say that he made the features a little exaggerated so that after 1,000 years, that the weathering would actually shape the face to the what he wanted them to be?
I've not heard that. If that's something that he said, that's not something that I have read. But you know, that wouldn't surprise me. He was very attuned to you know, Rushmore's present, but also its future, and that was something that I can easily say him or easily visualize him saying. I think, you know, what has become apparent though is that one of the things that the National Memorial does is upkeep on the sculpture, because it is, you know, despite it being carved into the granite, there are parts of it that are indeed quite fragile. And so, you know, there could be an instance where like the tip of Thomas Jefferson's nose, you know, might fall off, or the cracks, you know, in the president's might grow more deeply over time. In which case, if it was unattended to, things might sort of disintegrate in a natural sort of way.
Taking another break, I'm going to get Judy on the air with her question. You can call in with yours. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. I do want to ask you about the 1980 Supreme Court decision that called the Black Hills a seizure, a dishonorable dealing. So we're going to talk about that and more when we come back from the break. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies, Mount Rushmore. We're talking about a new book about that monument, A Biography of a Mountain, The Making and Meaning of Mount Rushmore. You can call in 833-877-8255. Let's go to Judy. And Judy, you're on the air with Matt Davis, the author of the book.
Thank you. A number of years ago now, I saw a documentary that was talking about another enormous sculpture that was either being built or I think it was maybe in the process, but they ran out of money. I'm not clear on the details, but it was supposed to be a sculpture of maybe the chief of the Lakota or one of the other Indian cultures that was well known. I'm wondering if the author knows anything about that and whether it got finished.
All right, Judy, thank you for that call. Matt Davis.
Yeah, you know, actually, Judy, thank you. And we were talking earlier about these sculptures built into rock. I completely forgot about the Crazy Horse Memorial, and I think that's what you're referring to. The Crazy Horse Memorial is literally, as a crow flies, about 15 minutes away from Mount Rushmore, also in the Black Hills of South Dakota, just outside of Custer, South Dakota. And yeah, it is an ongoing mammoth sculpture to the Lakota military leader, Crazy Horse. And that monument, that memorial is not complete. That also has a very fraught history. But that there is another memorial being built in the Black Hills, that is similar to Rushmore in the sense that it's being carved directly into the granite, but very different in terms of how it came to be and what it represents.
And they, the Lakota, are refusing to take any federal money for that monument.
Well, it's not the Lakota that's in charge of that monument, and that's a really important point. I mean, the idea behind it came from a sculptor who had worked at Rushmore for not too long, for about a week or two, until he was dismissed. And then he worked with some Lakota leaders in the area and decided that it would make sense to build kind of a rival monument to Mount Rushmore in the form of Crazy Horse. And that monument, like I said, that the its origins and its history is very fraught. Many Lakota people I've spoken to in the Black Hills do not agree that it's being carved into the Black Hills. They don't like the fact that it's desecrating the Black Hills. Many don't like that. Until recently, there was a family that was benefiting financially from the carving of Crazy Horse, a non-native family. And so that memorial itself has a lot of complicated histories to it.
So the 1980 Supreme Court decision, it called the Black Hills seizure, a case of dishonorable dealing that the United States should compensate the Lakota people for the taking of Mount Rushmore. So what happened on that?
Yeah, the Supreme Court agreed with the lower court that a quote, more ripe and rank case of dishonorable dealing will never be found in American history. And that case is the terminus of decades of legal wrangling between the Lakota and the US federal government. And we say that the land is stolen. I mean, we have to, that's truly what happened. I mean, there was a treaty in 1868 called the Treaty of Fort Laramie that was signed between the United States and the Lakota Nation that gave the Lakota what is today the entire western half of South Dakota, including the Black Hills, where of course Mount Rushmore stands. And just several years after that treaty was signed, the United States entered a very deep financial panic, sort of the initial Great Depression. And both morale was needed to be boosted and economic optimism needed to be found. And so George Armstrong Custer led an expedition through the Black Hills in 1874, a controversial expedition, to ostensibly look for a military fort. But the real reason most people knew was to try to find gold in the Black Hills. And Custer's expedition did find gold. And what happened after that was that many miners came flooding into the hills. Ulysses S. Grant, who was the president at the time, had tried to prevent miners from going in. The Treaty of 1868 had forbade any Americans from coming into Lakota territory. But now Grant just could not stop the swarm of people trying to find gold. And so he ordered all Native Americans in that area onto American-run reservations. And those that did not go to reservations would, according to one scholar, be rounded up. And so that's where George Armstrong Custer enters the conversation again. And he engages with thousands of Lakota and Northern Cheyenne at the Battle of Little Bighorn in late June 1876. Of course, Custer and his 7th Cavalry are wiped out. Word gets back about Custer's defeat as the United States is celebrating its centennial in Philadelphia in July 1876. And in revenge, the United States takes the Black Hills from the Lakota. And what the Supreme Court ruled, I mean, this was not a case to give the land back, it was a case of compensation. And so in 1980, the Supreme Court ruled that the US government owed the Lakota $102 million for that seizure, illegal seizure, of the Black Hills. But at that time, the Lakota refused the money, and they still have refused the money, which with interest has accrued to over $1 billion. And what the Lakota want is their land back, not the money for the land.
Will they ever get the land back? And what would they do with it?
I don't know. That's a tricky question, David. I mean, I find it hard to believe that the Lakota will ever see the land back from the U.S. government. That could change. But in terms of what they would do with it, I would ask their leaders what they would do with it. I've heard different, explanations or ideas, or one person I spoke to on the ground in South Dakota, who is Lakota, shared with me an idea of just, letting the memorial fold back into nature, just sort of having there be no upkeep, having some information around it about the people who had lived there for thousands of years, the impact on the Lakota, just having the memorial sort of fade away. And I don't know what else the Lakota would do with the other lands, but that's something that you should ask a Lakota leader.
Well, I've heard or read, and I don't know what to believe anymore when you read stuff online, that they want to blow it up.
Yeah, certainly I'm sure there's some desire for that, but I've also heard the exact opposite, that people just, like I said, want to sort of, let it fade into the background. I think just as some Lakota people I've spoken to are concerned about the construction of Crazy Horse in the Black Hills, many would not want to see more desecration done to the Black Hills themselves by blowing up Mount Rushmore.
What about co-managing the site? Could the Lakota and the National Park Service do something like that?
I can see that as a really interesting arrangement. I mean, and I don't think that's an impossible ask. I mean, I think you're already, like I referenced earlier, these new films that are being developed to show at Mount Rushmore. And those films were developed in consultation with the tribes who are affiliated with the Black Hills. So there's already these sorts of partnerships, these informal and sometimes formal partnerships that are developing to tell, a broader story of Mount Rushmore. And that's why, when you asked whether Rushmore is it possible for it to be sort of a place where you can tell a complicated history, that's where my optimism lays. It's in that kind of conversation, that kind of different ideas and programming that could make it possible.
What is the experience like going to Mount Rushmore? Do you think everyone should go?
I think it depends on when you go, because you're going to have a different experience depending on the season. I think people should go. I when I was writing this book, my routine was always to land at the Rapid City Airport and get in my rent-a-car if I was borrowing a friend's car and drive up to Rushmore, because the Black Hills themselves are so beautiful and so sublime. And then the mountain, Rushmore, it is worth seeing, and it's worth considering why it's there, who built it, why the land was taken by the United States, the sort of the trauma that has been foisted generationally upon the Lakota people and other Native American tribes. I think if you can consider all that, then I think, yes, Mount Rushmore is a very worthwhile place to go see, to think about all that. And, for me, the best time to go is the fall. I love October in the Black Hills. I was just in the Black Hills a few weeks ago. The summer can get pretty crazy with the crowds. But I really, really enjoy it in the fall. And I also enjoy it actually in the winter, when it's really quiet and really cold, and just a very interesting moment for introspection and reflection.
When you look at it, I mean, I would think about it would changes throughout the day as the sun moves across the sky. Does that happen?
It does. Yeah, it does. It really does. There's moments when, I mean, one of the reasons why Borglum loved this mountain to carve these faces is that it faced south. And so the sun really does add an element to it where they brighten up as the day sort of moves forward. And I think you can sort of, and as the sun goes down, the light as the sun is setting affects the colors of the stone, of the granite that the faces are carved into.
Historian and author Matthew Davis, his new book is A Biography of a Mountain, The Making and Meaning of Mount Rushmore. Matt, thank you so much for talking to us.
This has been great. Thank you, David. And if anyone's in Houston listening, I will be in Houston on December 3rd at Basket Books.
Awesome. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Thanks for listening.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted by David Martin Davies. Tim Gutierrez is the show's producer. Additional production support from Steve Short, Ruben Garcia, Yvette Benavides, and Dan Katz, Vice President of News. The Source is made possible with support from the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.